Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. In this episode, we're featuring my interview with author Steve Almond. Steve is the author of 9 books of fiction and nonfiction, including the New York Times bestsellers Candy Freak and Against Football. His latest book, Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country, is an earnest and clear-headed attempt to make sense of the various cultural forces that led to the election of Donald Trump. Almond guides readers through an often difficult look at many of the assumptions that underpin our understanding of our country and society. Steve Almond, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I'm glad. I look forward to depressing everyone.
Yeah, that's our goal, especially in these news times. So I want to point out that in the opening chapter of the book, you say that the election of Donald Trump was definitely the impetus for writing Bad Stories, but not necessarily the subject of the book.
Yeah.
So unpack that a little bit for us. What was it about the election that set you off on this project, and what did you hope to figure out?
Yeah, so the way that I saw it happening in the campaign, but even before that, and especially election night, was that we're very focused as Americans, maybe as human beings, on results, the outcomes. Mm-hmm. And we're not as good at recognizing that the outcomes are authored by a set of stories that we tell ourselves. As a species, that's what separates us from the other species. That's what allowed us to survive, is that we're capable of creating stories. And when the stories are well-intentioned, they end up fostering behavior that's merciful and cooperative and that sort of serves the collective good. And on the other side of it, when they're bad stories, so an example would be, for instance, the Beatitudes, the Sermon mm-hmm. on the Mount, whether or not that's a true story is less important than the fact that it's intended to awaken people's mercy.
Yes.
Yeah. That's why that story gets told. That's why it's a bestseller. On the other side of it, there are stories that are consciously and unconsciously intended to sow discord, to hide ourselves from particular scary realities, predicaments that we face, in some ways that are an expression of the monstrous parts of our inner life. And those stories always lead to bad outcomes. So what I was trying to do is step back from the news cycle, which if you put your hand in it is like putting your hand in a blender these days and say, okay, we got to this place where clearly a person who would not be allowed on my children's playground based on bragging about sexual predation and teasing disabled people and being openly and racist, dot, dot, dot. This is not a person who would be allowed on my kid's playground, but he is the leader of the country by the electoral math that we use. So how did that happen? And to answer that question, I felt like I needed to step back and say, hold on. We've been constructing bad stories that this particular demagogue, political actor exploited since before we had a country. The whole idea of race is our sort of original bad story. It was the original con of trying to distract people from economic justice by getting them to buy into racial resentment, inventing the idea that there's some imaginary pigmentary alliance that should make a poor European American with white skin in somehow an alliance with the person to whom he's an indentured servant. And our whole founding set of documents, the stories that we were telling in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, were patently fraudulent, right? They were wishful.
Yeah.
All men are created equal. Come on. That didn't apply to anybody who was African American. It didn't apply to women. They didn't have the vote until 100 years later. So there are these basically wishful stories that we're telling about America that weren't true then, and we discovered or rediscovered in 2016 that they still were wishful. They weren't the reality that we're living. They're a set of myths that we're accepting.
Yeah, and there's another line in here that I underlined because I really loved that America is a nation born of high ideals and low behaviors. Yeah. Like, we all have this idea of ourselves as a society as really free and open and equal and but if you actually look at the history of our country, we fall short of that pretty much all the time.
Yeah, and I'd say that the we in that statement really doesn't include people of color, right? It doesn't include women even today. Mm-hmm. That kind of set of freedoms that we imagine is really the set of freedoms imagined by or promulgated by people like me, white men with a certain amount of economic and even political and cultural power. It's certainly not true, and it's never been true. One of the interesting bad stories for me to investigate, having lived in El Paso, was the idea that we really have always been a nation of immigrants. We have promulgated that belief and that high ideal. And at the same time, you know, I quote a New York Times editorial from 120 years ago when they were basically saying, well, you should lynch these Sicilians who are making trouble down in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. They're rattlesnakes. They're not. They're lower than rattlesnakes. And you're saying that's not some crazy right-wing conspiracy theory website. That was the New York Times editorial board saying that about Italian Americans, just like people, you know, the Irish, mm-hmm. the Catholics, the Chinese who were murdered, you know, mass murdered and exploited to build the railroads. You know, we forget because we sort of get locked in the present that we've always had an incredibly ambivalent and charged relationship when it comes to immigration.
You bring up the idea of the story that we're a nation of immigrants and we're this melting pot. And you bring up the Irish and Italian specifically at the beginning of this century, essentially. And, you know, those people have become white in our society. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's my background. My family is Irish and Italian, and I have members of my extended family who are vehemently anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim. And it's really difficult to, you know, once a group has become assimilated into the majority,
right,
they easily forget that they weren't always that way.
Right. Something about trying to sort of pull up the ladder behind you. Mm. But it's part of a larger and ongoing kind of bad story, which is that we have a tendency to exalt our grievances as a way of hiding from our vulnerabilities. You know, we've been seeing playing out before us the spectacle of somebody's monstrous grievance, completely erasing, basically male rage, erasing female trauma. That's also a story that we live out over and over and over again in the context of individual relationships and sort of even in our political theater. And I think when somebody comes along who is pushing all of those buttons inside of people in a very powerful way, a political actor or a demagogue, unless we step back and examine exactly what buttons he's pushing and how they got installed, it doesn't help to just revile a particular political actor or demagogue. Because if we don't unpack those stories, we're just vulnerable to the next person who comes along. And the next person who comes along might have much more of a program, might be much more willing to exploit the degradation of our judiciary, the degradation of our law enforcement and this increasing sense of paranoia and suspicion about federal government, state government, any government. I mean, I don't have to tell you that. In Spokane, there's in the West in general, in this area in particular, a lot of people rightfully or because of bad stories who are deeply mistrustful of the government. And partly, I think, hiding from the reality that the government partly is helping them get along in things.
Well, before we get too far into it, I do want to have you read a bit from the book because one of the things that I found is the prose is just so clear. And I love the way that the book is structured in these really short segments that sort of take one idea or one story and break it down really clearly. So is there a part that you want to read?
I'll certainly try to find something that talks a little bit about story. Hopefully this isn't too long, but it kind of explains what the book is trying to do. Because the other thing that I'm not a social scientist and I'm not also an academic and I'm not even a journalist. I'm kind of an apostate journalist. I did it for several years, but I'm a storyteller. I became more interested in the story of the inner life and how it functions. And literature, that's what literature is trying to do. So for me, the lens that I could use was storytelling and books to understand how we got to this moment. So this section explains that a little bit. As I struggled to make sense of the 2016 election, my mind kept spiraling back to one particular scene in American literature. Ahab perched upon the quarterdeck of the Pequod with a prosthetic leg fashioned from a whale's jawbone. The captain has come to announce the true nature of his mission, which is not economic in nature but deeply personal. He seeks revenge against the Leviathan that maimed him and exhorts his crew with a soliloquy Trumpian in pitch, if not diction. And here's what Ahab says. He's kind of roaring up there. All visible objects are but pasteboard masks. If man will strike, strike through the mask. How can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall shoved near to me. I also just want to include some of Melville's prose because it's so sensational. Shoved near to me. Sometimes I think there's naught beyond, but 'tis enough. He tasks me He heaps me. I see in him outrageous strength with an inscrutable malice sinewing it. That inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate, and be the white whale agent or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. Which is not even the subtext, but the actual text of every Trump tweet. It is this volcanic sense of grievance that fuels Melville's saga that binds the crew of the Pequod to their leader. Ahab's quenchless feud seemed mine, Ishmael tells us rather helplessly. Who can blame the kid? Ahab is something like a natural force, a vortex of vindication as mighty as the beast he pursues. And then I go on to describe the end of the book where everybody's taken down by the whale, including Ahab, with the exception of Ishmael, who kind of basically just barely lives to tell the tale. The plot of Moby Dick pits man against the natural world, but its theme pits man against his own nature. The election of 2016 was, in its way, a retelling of this epic. Whether you choose to cast Trump as agent or principal hardly matters. What matters is that Americans joined the quest. Whether in rapture or disgust, we turned away from the compass of self-governance and toward the mesmerizing drama of aggression on display, the capitalist id unchained and all that it unchained within us. Trump struck through the mask, and it was enough. When I started writing this book in the months after the election, I was furious and frightened, worn down by decades of disappointment, and determined mostly to launch harpoons at those I imagined to be my adversaries. I am struggling in these pages to see Trumpism in a different light, as an opportunity to reckon with the bad stories at the heart of our great democratic experiment, and to recognize that often embedded within these stories are beautiful ideals and even correctives that might help us to contain the rage that has clouded our thoughts. And, you know, what I'm basically saying is what's going to save us is if we can tell the story. What redeems the story of Ahab and Moby Dick is that Ishmael is there to say this is what happens when the only thing that is driving the conversation, the only thing that gets us out on the ship into the quest, into the world, is a kind of unchained, wounded masculine ego. And, you know, so much of that to me, especially as we're watching, you know, the Kavanaugh hearings, that's what it is. It is the story that we tell over and over and over again, which is that male rage is the only thing we should pay attention to. In fact, we should pay attention to it as a way of not paying attention to female trauma.
My guest is Steve Almond, author of many books of fiction and nonfiction, including most recently Bad Stories, which we've been discussing. And you bring up Moby Dick, which you return to time and time again throughout the book.
Yeah.
And at one point you say, the great peril of our age is that we've become a nation not of Ahabs but of Ishmaels, passive observers. So can you unpack that a little bit for us in how we've become a nation of observers of what's happening to our country
yeah.
at the hands of Moby right. Dick, who you know, equate to someone like Trump.
Yeah, Ahab. Yeah, I mean, yeah, really, he is Moby Dick. I mean, that's the thing about Ahab. He's just uncontrolled natural aggression.
Yeah.
I think very specifically male aggression, but whatever. It's just animal aggression. And I think what the pattern that I see in myself and that I see in sort of that makes us especially vulnerable is that in the face of that kind of out of control and very seductive rage and grievance, our response is to sort of sit back and hate watch it rather than to recognize that the only way that there's a moral shift in the country is if people get up off of their couches and put some skin in the game and reinvigorate their faith in the duties of citizenship. And that could just be voting, but it could also be something more than that. Rosa Parks didn't get up on a bus in Birmingham, Alabama, and suddenly the Civil Rights Act was passed. Millions of Americans felt a moral awakening that the cruelty of segregation and Jim Crow and that legacy, the legacy of slavery really hadn't been fully addressed and hadn't been reckoned with, and they weren't okay with it. And there were very powerful forces that were trying to argue that that's what it should, that white people should be more powerful, African Americans should, you know their place and dot, dot, dot. They didn't go away. They were literally, people had to take the risk of becoming involved as citizens, becoming the subjects of history rather than the objects of history. Part of the argument I'm making in Bad Stories is that one thing that's characteristic of everybody in America is we've become complacent. We sort of think we're the only superpower, and we become sort of lost in a pattern of hate-watching democracy's demise rather than recognizing we're responsible for it. It's not a self-driving car. It can go off the rails. You can have a degradation of your judiciary and your law enforcement and our fourth estate. And that can happen right before our eyes. And if our only response on the right is to have demagogues who are ginning up fear and trying to make more, America into a horror movie that you should be frightened of, where the dark other is always hovering in the peripheries on the border or in a sleeper cell in your community, that's going to cause people to be very politically active. And if on the left your approach to those demagogues and bad political actors is to make a joke out of them, is to say, yeah, they're entertainment, they're material for Colbert or Stewart or Trevor Noah or whoever else, you're doing something equally dangerous. You are essentially preying off people's loss of faith in the fact that their citizenship matters, and none of this is a joke. It's not something that can be laughed away. I think people of good faith on the left are frightened, really. And they're morally distressed. They're anguished that these dark stories have overtaken the good stories about all the things that we might do. We might address climate change. We might address the insane inequality of wealth in this country. I mean, when I was a baby, there was a war on poverty. And I watched that become the war on drugs. And then it became the war on terror, which is a war on an emotion. And then, that metastasized into a war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And now I believe we really have a war on the poor. I think that's what's happening. There is consciously an effort to aggregate wealth and power. And that doesn't go away without people, us, rising up and saying, we're not okay with that arrangement anymore. But I think we've fallen in, and I write at length in the book about we are agreeing to the bad story that politics is some form of entertainment. Mm-hmm. And it's our job merely to consume it and to either view it with rapture, oh my God, there's my savior, or with disgust, oh, can you believe what those such and suches are doing? I feel like the central thing I'm trying to suggest is there is no such thing as bad people. That's a bad story. They're just all of us people who are filled with and constantly battling within ourselves with good stories and bad stories, whether we're going to be generous and kind and merciful and try to exercise that in the world and hopeful and see Watergate as a hopeful story about a nation's idealism, or are we going to give in to a kind of easy cynicism and say, oh, well, Watergate just proves that they're all corrupt. And I know that because Jon Stewart tells me that in a very funny way every night.
Right. I mean, there's been a perfect example of what you just laid out in the last week with the Kavanaugh hearings from, we saw in his most recent testimony in front of the Senate Judiciary panel, that kind of unchecked raw male emotion. And I think there were people who were really shocked and horrified by that. And there were other people who were really fired up by that.
Right.
And the response from the left that I think perfectly fits into what you were saying was the Saturday Night Live cold open with Matt Damon, where all he did was like give us exactly what we had just seen, except it was a famous actor doing it, so it was funny.
Right.
And our response was to watch it as a spectator sport.
And I get that because it's frightening to watch not just that kind of unchecked male aggression and sort of monstrous entitlement, but it's also to see that that's the story that gets told. That's not the story.
Right.
The story is that a woman and women, it turns out, were traumatized, or at least say credibly that they were traumatized. And there's not a person in that entire room, including the senators, who didn't know that she was telling the truth. Everybody understood at halftime that somebody has just come forward and told a very painful truth, and a truth that is making people weep all over the country because they've lived that same experience. And what were they going to do to try to get rid of that story, to try to erase it? And what they did was carted out the oldest trick in the book, which is just male aggression, rage, Ahab. Rah, how dare you? This is a witch hunt. Da, da, da. It's a straight line through McCarthyism and the know-nothings and straight back to the demagogues that were in operation 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And you have to remember, he's applying for the job of being an impartial justice in the highest court of the judiciary.
Right.
And he didn't convince anybody that that event didn't take place. What he convinced them of is, I, as a white man, have the right to be furious when somebody says something bad about me. Mm. It's not my job to reckon with it. It's not my job to even answer your questions. In fact, if you're going to ask me about getting blackout drunk, I'm going to throw it back. Are you blackout drunk? What about you? Have you ever been blackout drunk? His behavior was so out of control. It was out of control in the same way that Trump's behavior is out of control, in the same way that Ahab's behavior is out of control, in a way that's very familiar to us. He didn't convince people that he was credible in terms of those allegations. He dodged and weaved and did everything he could to try to avoid what was clearly the reality, which is that, like a lot of Americans, he struggled at one time in his life with both anger and the use of alcohol, and it made him belligerent. And specifically, based on these allegations, had a pattern of behaving towards women in assaultive or humiliating ways. Yeah. And it's deeply disappointing to see senators fall for that. It's even more disappointing to see that be the only story that comes out of that. Again, I feel like Blasey Ford was erased. And we had the template for that. I think what we're realizing is this is really how a significant and very politically active portion of the country operates. They're okay with a pedophile potentially winning office for the Senate. They're okay with an overt racist who's a sexual predator, right, being the president, who announces it. I'm not saying anything Trump didn't say at work, okay? So then the question becomes, they've said who they are. Who are we? And that, I think, is the real sort of question that Bad Stories is trying to ask. Are we going to be able to tell a different story about our generation? And if we don't, what are our kids going to think? And what are their kids going to think? If at this crucial moment where real sort of existential threats to the species are bearing down on us, and certainly threats to the empire, did we hold ourselves responsible? Were we the subjects of history, or we were just the objects of history who watched it all happen and caught the Saturday Night Live thing and thought it was political action to share that on Twitter?
Well, this is obviously a really crucial conversation that I think we could continue all day. But I do want to shift gears a little bit to the reason why you're here, which is to teach and lecture about fiction at the Eastern Washington's MFA program. Yeah. So we can segue nicely from your identifying as a storyteller and saying we need to tell the right kinds of stories. So what do you see as your role in writing fiction? What kind of stories are you trying to tell in a different way than you do in your nonfiction or journalism?
Yeah, I think what I would say is that the way that I square the two of them, when people, because a lot of, you know this, as a writer, a lot of writers, especially writers of fiction, mm-hmm. and I write mostly short stories, so that's like way at the, that's so far at the edge of the culture that I can see over the edge.
Yeah.
Right? You know, the question is like, why am I even bothering in an age where we have, you know, sort of threats to the democracy and so forth and a million distractions? Why even bother? It's too esoteric. But that's part of the reason I quote Joseph Conrad at the end of Bad Stories. Like, if you're not pursuing art, the making of art, the consuming of art, the reckoning with our inner lives and our capacity to recognize beauty, what are you fighting wars for? Right? That's Churchill. Why the hell are you fighting a war if not for art? And I think there's something in for me, the writing of stories that's an effort. It's not a political act, but it's a moral act. It's trying to make somebody feel more human afterwards. It's trying to get the reader to, I guess, sort of expose the part of themselves that is in one way or another in some kind of emotional danger or in pain. And that's what, for me, great writers do, and especially great short story writers, because that's such a compressed form. You're trying to make people feel something they didn't feel before. It was in there. It just needed a means to get out. And the story maybe provides that. It doesn't automatically make people more virtuous. It just means that they stop, I want to use a word I can't use on radio, but bull bleeping, you know. They stop sort of trafficking in the idea that they aren't heartbroken every day.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the big bewildering things that all of us try to struggle with, how do we survive loss, our own bad behavior, the cauldron of our childhood, whatever it is, that we're somehow walking around not deeply heartbroken and also hopeful and inspired and deeply feeling about all that stuff. That's what, for me, that's the reason I left journalism, because it wasn't asking enough questions about the inner life.
Yeah, I listened back to, you were interviewed for Spokane Public Radio back in 2012 when you were coming for Get Lit,
okay.
for our local literary festival, and you described writing, or more generally art making, as throwing a rope of love and seeing who hangs on.
Yeah.
And I really loved the imagery of that sentiment of like just putting out something, an emotion, and seeing who else, you know, identifies with that emotion.
Yeah. And that's the way I think about as I teach. I'm always saying to students, like, well, I think most of short stories is like building ramps to moments that really matter, where a character's overrun by dangerous feeling, right? Desire, fear, dread, rage, lust, whatever it is, out of control emotion. I think we're in our civilian lives constantly depriving ourselves of those out of control emotions and sort of trying to tamp down our obsessions and the things that make us feel out of control. But internally, we want to connect to that. So what I'm always interested in stories is, did you build a ramp, a reliable ramp, psychologically and emotionally, to a moment that mattered? And then did you slow the hell down and force the character to experience it? Because then the reader gets to experience it. And so when I look at a story, that's kind of what I'm interested in. I know there's all this stuff about craft, and I'm happy to talk about narration and characterization and scene and summary and all that stuff. But at the bottom of it, it's like, Wilco, are you trying to break my heart? In some way or another, are you trying to really reach me emotionally?
And I would be remiss to my public radio audience if I didn't ask you about your podcast that you had with Cheryl Strayed, Dear Sugars. So it was a really popular podcast that was, I think, it was kind of another form of bridging that emotional gap between listeners in what you answered readers' questions in the form of radical empathy, which I love that that was your description of what you were trying to do in the show.
Yeah.
And it recently came to an end. So what happened?
Yeah.
Is there more radio from you in the future, or a podcast?
Maybe. I like it. I think it's intimate. You know, there's this kind of our storytelling – to go back to the beginning, was like this.
Yeah.
You know, it's a parent reading to you in the dark, or somebody telling a story around a, you know, camp. And it's there's an intimacy to somebody's voice being in your ear. You can be in your kitchen, you know, but it sort of takes you away. It's got a quality, I think, that's very ancient, that we are a storytelling species and we need to hear stories. In the case of Dear Sugars, stories about people who are in pain and trying to figure out not just if they're going to get out of it, but if anybody else will actually consent to see it. And that's what we're trying to do, basically. And Cheryl's a natural at that, and I love doing that as well. It is very much, as you say, kind of a related endeavor. Mm-hmm. If a short story can be thought of as this kind of voice of, not wisdom necessarily, but of experience and a kind of outrageous courage that we don't frequently, emotional courage that we don't frequently traffic in. That's, I think, what Cheryl and I were interested. The people who wrote those letters were so eloquent. People would always say, oh, did you edit them? You must have rewritten. And we're like, nope. We maybe sometimes cut a little bit if there was repetition or tried to clarify a few things. But basically, people are really good writers if they're telling the truth about the things that matter to them the most deeply, in simple and direct language. Everybody, every human being is a great writer if they'll allow themselves to do that. And we set up a show really at Cheryl's instigation with her column that basically said, we're here, we're listening, and we'll do our best to pay attention to it. And I think what Dear Sugars was trying to say, and what I try to say in my work, is actually attention is the first and final act of love. That's how you love the world, is that you pay attention to it. And when things are especially painful, that's when you have to really not turn away. You have to be brave enough to stay in the room and see what's happening. And, you know, I love doing that with Cheryl. I'm very sorry that we're not doing it anymore. And, you know, I might have to find another way. The next book for me will be an effort to talk about some of these ideas, because they do preoccupy me. Like, I went into journalism. There's a reason that I couldn't ultimately do that work. I needed to find a way to throw out the rope of love. Like, that needed to be my first and most important job.
Yeah. My guest has been Steve Almond, who is the author of many books, including most recently Bad Stories. Steve, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, it's great to be back in Spokane. I'm really happy.
Thank you. You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. You can find a podcast of this and other past episodes online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. The music in this episode is by Dr. Turtle. Executive producer of The Bookshelf is Vern Windham. And I'm Chris Messini.